This is James Andrew, interviewed by Chris Alden Lee on the 8th of July 2003 at Reigate in Surrey. Dr. James Andrew.
James Darby Andrew. I married a Joan, of course. And she died last year. In fact, last weekend was the anniversary of her birth, her death. And I was born on the 29th of August, 1919.
So you're now 83?
3 years. Well, in a month.
And the years you were in the Antarctic were?
I joined up in 1945, after the war, when it came to an end. I was going to go into the Navy, but they took me on as the equivalent of a naval lieutenant, I think. Surgeon lieutenant. In the colonial office, that we ran it. Mm-hmm. And what did you ask me?
I was asking you about what you were doing before you signed up for the Antarctic.
Oh, yes, well, I was the house surgeon at Barts for most of the war. In fact, I was there when that V2 landed on Smithfield Market at 11 o'clock. We had 147 major casualties within three quarters of an hour, arms off, legs off, penetrating wounds of the abdomen, chest and head. We worked for 3 days and three nights without stopping.
We being a team?
Yeah, well, we had 12 theatres. Every bed in the hospital was occupied mattresses on the floor. And it nearly killed me. Well, the blast was quite bad. Those are the things, if you remember, you heard them coming after they'd blown up. So if you heard them coming, you knew you were all right. Provided you weren't buried in rubble.
So how many surgeons would have been? Were they called in doctors from elsewhere?
No, well, we transferred some to the Royal Free and one or two other places, I think, took them. But it was right on our doorstep. Mm. And everybody from there said, take us to Barts.
How did you come to sign up for the Antarctic then? Tell me the story of your...
Well, now that's interesting. It was after the war had just come to a close. And I said, we were talking at lunch around the medical staff's table. And I said I thought I was going to go into the Navy. And Michael Roberts, who was sitting at the table with me, he was my junior house surgeon. I was a senior house surgeon. He was the junior one. He said, well, I was going to go down to the Antarctic, but I can't because I'm going to get married. My wife won't let me. So I said, oh, are you? And I said, tell me more. Because I had always been fascinated by the Antarctic since I was at school. And he said, well, you'll have to get to speak to Brian Roberts, who is at the colonial office, and talk to him about it. Which eventually he came round to see me, actually, because I was on duty most of the time. And I was interviewed, and I went to see Captain Bingham, and eventually they took me on. At that stage, they were desperate to get people to come, actually, and they were commandeering people up to the ranks of brigadier to get them. In fact, Colonel Paddy Mayne was one of the people who was taken down, but we had to send him back, unfortunately.
What rank were you offered then, James?
Well, a surgeon lieutenant.
So it was because you were a doctor they were keen to have you?
Yes. Well, and I was interested. I went down to do a research program of bacteriology because nothing much had been done down there in those terms. But most of my equipment got left behind in a dock strike. When I got down there, I just couldn't do anything, really. So I sat around learning how to... I looked after the dogs to start with. Their veterinary problems and all the rest. And I learned how to survey to a degree, and I was responsible for the annotations on the wildlife around everywhere. In fact, I set up the first penguin survey with the details of the nests of pairs that I carefully measured from a specific visible and recognisable point, so because we didn't know whether they came back to the same nests the following year, nor how long they lived, nor how whether they came back with the same partners, or all the other things. And this was a way of finding out, and it was subsequently taken on by my colleague Bill Sladen.
Which base was this?
Hope Bay.
Hope Bay.
Well, there was a rookery there of over 100,000 birds.
Did he mark the birds then?
Yes.
In what way?
Do you know, I've forgotten. I marked their nests, actually. Oh, I think I ringed them. Yes, that was it.
And marked
them. And got some rings, yes. Yeah, I ringed them.
And was that the first study of that kind done?
That, well, it hadn't been done before.
And your conclusions were that they...
Well, I didn't know. I couldn't make the conclusions. I wasn't there the following year. I had to leave it to somebody else. Unfortunately, I don't know if Michael Roberts did any work on it, but Bill Sladen was able, with my compass bearings on various points and measurements, to pick out where the nests were and which the birds were. So he was given a really good start.
Did you mark every nest and every bird, or just...
No, I just took a sample of about... Cool, it's a huge labour, that, you know. You had to watch them for quite a while, because I didn't... You can't tell very easily whether they're males or females, except by their behaviour, and which belong to which. And they stay together, and they stay together the following year, I believe. Anyway, we...
Do you remember what species of bird it
Yes,
was?
It was a daily.
A daily. Yeah.
We had a few Gentoos down there as well, in the rookery, but it was the daily. And we came across a few emperor penguins.
Did they object to being studied or poked about with?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes, they thought you were a big penguin coming to pinch their nest. Stones, which they carefully collected, made a nest of. And if they didn't want you there, they'd run up against you, grab your trouser or a bit of your clothing and beat you with their flippers. And it's like a boy with a stick running down iron railings. They were that fast with it. And it wasn't very comfortable. I had a huge respect for them. They were the most wonderful creatures. And those pounding they took when they got landed on the ice and the rocks from the sea when it was rough was unbelievable. And they got up straight away and walked off.
You mentioned that you were something of the cook on the base.
Yeah.
Did you make use of the penguins in that way?
Oh, rather, yeah. We ate a lot of penguins and seals. In fact, I don't think that did us much good, actually, because we were rather fond of the livers and kidneys, which were the nicest tasting bits.
Of a seal?
Yes. And, of course, they're rather overfull of some vitamins. And I think some of us got a bit upset by that, you know, ill. I know I did, because I was a bit of a pinkful. But seal meat was good to eat anyway.
Can you remember the recipes? What would you do?
Well, I'd do anything with them. Roast it, fry it, casserole it, make pies with it. We did all sorts of things with it. We didn't bother too much sometimes because we were jolly hungry. It was cold down there. I arrived down there weighing about 10.5 stone and I ended up at about 12 or 13, I think.
And penguins and their eggs, what would you do with those?
Well, we used to eat penguins' eggs. They were very good. But they were translucent when cooked. You could see through the... It didn't go opaque and white like a hen's egg. You could see through it. They were solid.
Right, even when boiled?
Yeah.
I hear about omelettes. Penguin omelettes.
Yeah, and I used to make sponge cakes. And we had... because they made me the cook. When I first arrived there on the 14th of December...
This is at Hope Bay.
Hope Bay. David James and Victor Russell was... Victor Russell was staying there, and David James was... stayed with them for company. And you know David James.
I know the name, yes.
Yeah. And he... Let me just think... Oh, they had a cook down with them, Jim Berry, the previous year, when Boy Scout Ma, Jimmy Ma, was in charge. He was with Scott, you know, down in 1915, 14. And when I arrived there, the other two looked at me and they said, "Can you cook?" I said, "Well, haven't we got anything to eat?" Well, he said, "We've run out of bread." And my mother had always insisted that we learn to do everything at home. She was a Victorian lady par excellence. And we were made, my brother and I, to do absolutely everything around the house, from making our beds to washing to cooking, you know, gardening, serving a table, how to lay them and all the rest of it. We were put through the mill.
So you were fully domesticated?
I was a highly domesticated chap, which was just as well. But I remember the first set of loaves I made dropped like bricks to the floor because I hadn't discovered how to make the yeast work properly at those temperatures.
Were you making bread?
Yes. Yeah. Oh, every day we made bread. And I used to make sponge cakes with the penguin's eggs when we got them. And I made a big batch one week, I remember. Because I thought, well, they like those pink cakes, so I'll make a few of those. And I made a whole lot and stuck them up on the top shelf out of the way. And we had one for tea that day. They must have watched what I was doing because I went back for another one the next day and they'd all gone. Every single one.
This was at Hope Bay?
At Hope Bay, yes. Yeah. We had a wonderful time at Hope Bay. Victor Russell was the most magnificent leader.
Why?
Well, I don't know. He was a natural leader. He had been a captain in the Royal Army Service Corps, wouldn't he? What do they call it? Surveyors Corps, or whatever it is. And he was a lovely chap. And
what was his leadership style like?
Oh, very, very straightforward and forthright. He said, "We'll do this and that and the other," and you did it. You know, there was a sort of certain authority and tone about his voice. You didn't argue with him.
So the decisions didn't follow a group discussion. They were
well, not really. No. Well, up to a point they did. You know, when we needed to. I remember on one occasion we were going out on the sea ice on our first venture and we ran into some troubles and Victor said, "Well, look," he called us all together to his tent. There were four of us, Thomas Sullivan, John Francis, Vic and myself. And he said, "Well, look, if I get into trouble, as I hear he nearly had, falling down a crevasse," he said, "John Francis will take over and carry on from there and do whatever we're going to do." And then he turned to me and he said, "And you'll be second in command, and if he gets into trouble, you have to take over." That just did for old Tom. He was a lovely chap. He was an Irishman. I had a great lot of time for him. He's died now, poor chap. I'm still in touch with his wife, Maureen.
This is?
Tom O'Sullivan. Mm. And we shared many a night in the tent. Oh, I'll tell you one thing that was amusing. Going down onto the sea ice down the east coast of the Graham Land Peninsula, the Antarctic Peninsula as it is now, we had only walkie-talkies, American-style walkie-talkies, which we could send messages to the base, but we couldn't receive. And one night, we'd had a busy night, day, and we were camped on the sea ice, and I was playing with this thing, seeing if I could get any response from it anywhere. And suddenly I heard music. So I turned it on, put it inside a couple of cooking pots to make it louder, and listened to it for a bit. And do you know what it was? The promenade concerts from the Albert Hall. And Tom and I lay on our backs on the sea ice on the east side coast of the Antarctic Peninsula, as it is now, listening to that program. It was absolutely wonderful.
Did you ever understand why it happened like that?
No, it was just a freak recording, I don't know. Must have bounced off a cloud or something.
Picking up the World Service.
Well, they didn't have the World Service in there. This was just after the war.
Yeah.
We had nothing when we went down there. I mean, we had dogs and sledges, and we were working like Scott. You know, we did a lot of man-hauling and drove dogs most of the time.
You've got lovely black and white pictures of your dogs around the wall here. Tell me a bit about them. You were telling me a little story a moment ago about one dog with a rather large...
Yeah, well, that's Sydney. No, Sydney up there was the lead dog in my team. I had 10. I had the heaviest sledge, and I was always at the back. And they used to get ice balls in their feet at times, and he got them in his, and they're pretty uncomfy. So I let him off the lead to run around. When we went out, I used to take my... we used to take a set of sandwiches with us, because going straight from the base food to pemmican and biscuits was not terribly good.
Sandwiches were a buffer zone for your stomach.
That's right.
Yeah.
And I used to keep them for a day or two. Of course, they froze solid in your bag and in your kit bag on the back of the sledge. And I put it on top of our hot cocoa to thaw out a bit. And old Sydney looked at this, and he gradually started inching his way in. And I kept a careful eye on him to see what he was going to do. It's in that book, actually, of Dogs and Men, this story. But he, of course, he was coming slightly closer all the time. And I was briefly distracted by something that somebody said to me and looked away. And in that moment, he went forward and he got the sandwich. And now what they do when they do that is to swallow it straight away. And I knew what was going to happen. And I said, "You're not going to have that, you Santa." And I threw myself on top of him and grabbed what was sticking out of his mouth and stuffed it in mine. He was all right. And what he did after that, I eventually got round to harnessing him back up again because he got the ice balls free. And I was busy doing this when I felt something warm on my leg. And I looked down, and the top of my sealskin boot was open, and he was busy peeing into it. Now, normally, the trees are in short supply down there, so normally they used to cock a leg, twist round, and then cock the other leg and keep doing that. And I counted him doing it 13 times in one spot. But this time he emptied his bladder into my boot, and I'm sure he did it on purpose. That'll teach you, you sense. And I paddle around in dog pee for the rest of the day.
There's one of your huskies behind you who had a rather large man.
Yeah.
Tell me the story again.
Well, he was just...
Who was this?
His name was Little Jack. And he was a bit short in the leg. And when the sow was soft, of course, he used to trundle along with the rest. But you could always tell where he'd been. He tended to pull out to the side of the sledge a bit, because there was a deep furrow going along between his leg pawmonks. So he always knew where little Jack had been.
This was his John Thomas. Yes. Yeah. We can jot about it, it doesn't matter about the structure as well. But one of the things he wanted me to ask you about particularly, you were being recruited when Operation Tabaroon was changing over to the FIDs.
That's right.
And so were you aware of any change in the way they recruited at that point? How were you recruited? You were interviewed?
I was interviewed by Bingham, yes.
Just by Bingham?
And by Brown Roberts in the Colonial Office.
How were your supplies and stores ordered? Because you were no longer...
Well, Bingham did that. Oh. You mean medical supplies?
Hmm.
Well, I think I took over what was down there. One thing I did do was to take 1 million units of penicillin. That was the first penicillin was ever taken down to the Antarctic, because we advanced. We were the first people using it, in a clinical way.
So you took that down off your own bat, did you?
Yeah, well, I'm not off my own bat, but I ordered it. They asked me what I wanted, and I told them various other things. I told them about this penicillin. And going through the list, Ted Bingham looked at it. He said, "What on earth do you want 1 million units of that for?" He'd got no idea about penicillin. He hadn't a clue. I mean, 1 million units was just enough to treat one person if they were very ill.
Did he have occasion to use it?
No, no. I left it down there because it kept pretty well in those cold temperatures.
You were joining this brand new organisation. It was no longer the Army or the Navy, the services. It was a new organisation.
Yeah.
So did you have any concept of what it was about?
How do you mean what it was about?
Well, how it was run. Was it very structured or very relaxed?
Well, it was structured to this extent that, there were various fixed bases and a leader in charge of each one. Bingham did all the organising. He'd been down to the Antarctic and the Arctic, of course, on the Greenland expedition and the British Greenland expedition earlier.
What did he make of him?
Oh, he's a lovely chap. A bit of a martinet. He didn't reckon much on doctoring. He was more keen on the dogs and the other activities, organising the show, which he did very well.
You talked about Victor. What are your memories of David James?
Well, David James was only there very briefly. And his father was a member of Parliament. In fact, he came back and represented Kemp Town in Brighton as the MP subsequently. And he was, he came down the following year with Borrowdale doing the background filming for Scott of the Antarctic, which Borrowdale did, and as the advisor, I got on with him very well.
And how about Captain Taylor? Did he come across him?
Yes, he was a nice, quiet chap. Canadian accent, of course. But I only saw him when we took over. The story of that, I might briefly read to you, actually, when we arrived.
These are your diaries kept at the time.
That's right.
And you say you were instructed to keep diaries.
Yeah, we were. We were told we'd got to. Being a good lad, I probably did. I always did what I was told, especially when my granny told me what to do. She was fierce. as they say in Ireland. Can't read these things. 16. We arrived off Hope Bay about 3 a.m. Bitterly cold. We arrived in the William Scoresby, this is, with Captain Marchese in command. I was taken specially down there ahead of everybody else. Can't think why. Oh, I had to go and see a chap called Bonner in Deception Island. And he was dying of cancer of the stomach, poor chap. And I had to look at him and sort him out. He got secondaries in the liver and he was really ill. And I went down, I was sent down there in the William Scoresby to see him. And while I was there, the Trapassi came in and they said I was to go on board straight away on the William Scoresby because they'd got to go and relieve them at Hope Bay. So the William Scoresby went off to Hope Bay and they arrived on January the 14th.
This is 1946.
Yeah, this is January the 14th, 1946. Spray was freezing on the deck and the rigging was coated with ice, bitterly cold, quite light, remained so all through the night. We could see the small huts, the bottom of the mountain fairly close to the shore with a Nissen hut and meteorological post around. The dogs could be heard barking faintly, and rows of penguins were porpoising across the bay to their rookery to the right of the hatch. My luggage was loaded into a boat and I was rowed ashore with Marchese and Nidri. He was the meteorologist from Port Stanley. It was a long pull and jolly glad we were to scramble out on the ice-covered rocks on land. Marchese walked out to the huts and found everyone asleep. He wakened them with a shout, "Doesn't anyone want to be relieved?" 2 mile broke loose with then as everyone got up, everyone was introduced. A lot of scurrying around, yelling, getting cases together and specimens. And of course they left fairly shortly afterwards.
James, what were you able to do for Bonner? Were you able to help him
much? No, he had to go. He was sent straight back by the first available ship. He'd been down there a year, and poor chap, he was earning money, good money for him, working on that base, to send his children to school. He got a son who got a scholarship in Montevideo and was hoping to go on to Cambridge with another scholarship, and he was earning the money to send him there. And I felt very sorry for him.
How long did he have?
I reckon he only had a month or two to live. I didn't hear what happened.
So you didn't hear whether Bass or Fids helped him out financially?
I have no idea. No. They might have done, I don't know.
Were you having to break the news to him?
Well, I told him he wasn't. Well, he knew he wasn't well. What did I say? Dr. Beck, I took over from. He's died since. He was down there with Jimmy Marr in 43.
Who else do you remember from those days? Some characters that stick out in your memory?
Well, all of them. I mean, there were only 8 of us at that base. We were a very mixed crew, I tell you.
How do you mean?
Well, we had There was Thomas Sullivan, John Francis, Vic Russell, the leader, Stuart Small, the radio operator, what's his name? The Falkland Islander, whose name I've temporarily forgotten. He was a nice chap too. And Bill Croft and myself.
Were there ever any tensions?
Or and Thomas there? Sullivan. No, we all got on remarkably well. We were a very mixed bunch. There was a member of the Church of Scotland, member of the Church of England, Roman Catholic, a Plymouth Brother, a Christian Scientist, an atheist, and I can't remember what the other was. Oh, a Norwegian church he belonged to. He got a Norwegian girlfriend.
So were,
Stuart Small.
Were there prayers held? Was there a service?
No, I don't think we ever had a service. As such, quite honestly, in those days, with eight of us, we were far too busy living to spend much time playing around. Not playing around, but taking time off. We used to occasionally take a Sunday rest, but we worked most days. You know, you were getting food, you were feeding the dogs, they had to be looked after and assessed every day. And
So the differences of religion never came into...
Well, they were all established in the first two or three weeks, and we had discussions about this and that and the other, but then nobody... We all got along incredibly well. I had a chap from Holland interviewing me one day about all this, and when he asked me specifically the questions you've been asking about, how do we get on together, were there any rows? And he couldn't understand it when I said, well, there weren't really. And he didn't want to know me after that. He was only interested in the altercations. Well, I mean, we might have had an odd tiff about something else.
But nothing significant.
Nothing really significant. Right. I used to annoy Thomas Sullivan in the tent. I can't remember what it was. And he used to annoy me because he used to smoke, and sucking his pipe made a terrible noise. But we got along perfectly well. There was never a major bleat.
Did Bingham change the way the dogs were used at all? Do you remember any fresh
approach? I don't quite know, but somehow or other, we at Hope Bay started using the wrong commands. I don't quite know why that was, because we worked with what's his name? Jimmy Marr. And the dogs responded to various words of command. Uk was left, Irra was right, Ah was stop, and now boys, wheat was go. And that was about all we used to say to them, except when they got a bit naughty.
I'm not clear.
And Victor Russell, I remember, because it's a very clear area there, down there. He was the best part of half a mile away looking at something. And he came back to me and he said, I heard what you said to that dog, James. I said, oh dear, did you?
I'm not clear. You say you were giving the wrong instructions. Can you elaborate?
Well, yes, because I believe the correct words are the other way around, left and right. I don't quite know.
Were there any changes in the way the dogs were on their leads, on their traces?
Well, we used various systems, but we preferred the central trace we didn't fix them on a short lead to each trace on each side. They had their own individual thing fixed to the central trace off the front of the sledge. So they all pulled, but they were two and two and two with the same length, And the bitch was in front, of course. Rachel, her name was. She was a good dog. I've got a picture. Oh, I tell you what I have got.
As a doctor on the base, you said you were in charge of the dogs medically as well.
Well, there was nobody else.
Yeah.
See, I have lots of abscesses and tree. They had mange at one time. And we hadn't got... It's in here somewhere. We hadn't got very much to treat them with. I think we had some Dettol-like substance. It wasn't Dettol in those days because it wasn't made then. But we had something similar. And I made up a barrel load of an oil barrel full of hot water with a can of this stuff inside it. And it was our dogs, the new ones, that seemed to have the trouble. But they spread it, of course, to the others. So we put all 60 dogs
60.
Through into that tub and pushed their heads under. And they came out spluttering and creating like mad and sat down, shook themselves and gave a good scurry around. And they all looked beautifully clean from the soap we'd put in too. And it got rid of the mange.
So it was a Dettol type antiseptic?
So, yeah. I can't remember what we... I've got it there somewhere.
Were you in charge of the breeding as well?
Well, yes. There wasn't much in charge. We had a dog called Colonel, who we reckon would get out of any cage we put him in if there was a bitch on heat. It was no good putting him in a cage. We had to put the bitches in.
So there was no programme as such?
No, there wasn't. We had ended up with 120. Well, they were quite glad of them, you know.
Did that cause feeding problems?
Well, we lost some from time to time. Some of them died. Captain, the lead dog, was a lovely thing, chap, and he used to be in charge of the show. He got a great thug of a dog, who's black Labrador, whose name I've temporarily forgotten, but he was an absolute thug, and he cottoned on to a captain, and captain used him. When he was no longer able physically to fight and control the others, he brought this one along with him, and there was no argument. He was still the boss.
He was as heavy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They were great fun. I enjoyed looking after them immensely. But I was surprised how many abscesses they got. Cuts and things and goodness, what else?
Where was the infection coming from in the Antarctic?
I don't know. Well, I suppose they're feces or whatever. Mm. I don't know. That's one of the things I wanted to find out. That's why I was going down with a bacteriological program, but couldn't do it.
Mm. So because you weren't able to fulfil your prime function, that's why you ended up being part of the team. Were you surveying as well?
Yes.
Yeah.
I've even got a glacier down there named after me. There were only three of us. John Francis has an island. Victor Russell has a huge glacier crossing it. And the Andrew Glacier opens into Charcot Bay on the west coast.
Did you name it?
No, I didn't name it. It was done by the... but it was only the people who did survey work whose names were put in. And I did quite a bit of survey work down there.
Was that something you had to learn on the hoof?
Yes.
What was that like?
Well, I understood things like theodolites and the like, you know. It wasn't too difficult. Putting two and two together. Well, I've been doing that most of one's life. Looking down microscopes and so on.
Are you all right, James?
Yeah, fine. My back's a bit bad because I've got two fractured vertebrae.
Well, you injured yourself down there, didn't you? Didn't you?
Oh, yeah.
I've been reading Ice and Men, and you broke a rib or something. What can you? They've asked me to ask you to see if there's more to the what happened than is written in Ice and Men. So can you elaborate?
Oh yes, there is. I know now how I broke my ribs. I broke a couple.
This was at Hope, wasn't
it? At Hope Bay. It was on our winter journey, and we were climbing up what is now the Russell Glacier, though in those days it was known as the Stanley Glacier. And I suppose we were about 1,000 feet up, and we had the most appalling weather. You know, it was snow, blizzards all the time, and whiteouts. And halfway up this glacier, we had to stop for the night. And trying to get the sledges free from the built-up snow, the dogs couldn't pull it out, so I threw myself at the sledge. And, of course, I cracked a rib in the process. 1,200 pounds I got on it. It's the heaviest stage in the lot, because it was the last one going through. And I had 10 dogs. The others had 6.
You launched yourself
at the back of the sledge.
You were trying to push it?
Yeah, to help them, you see.
And you slipped?
Break it out. Well, no, I hit it with my chest, and it didn't budge. My chest did. That was how the fractures occurred.
Did you know straight away what you'd done?
Well, I thought, no, not immediately, but it went on hurting rather a lot after that. So I got the chap I was with, who was the Falklander. What's his name? John Front? No, not. It's on that. Can you pass me the black book? I've forgotten his name, stupid idiot. I'm getting...
Well, it is 60 years ago.
Well, yes, it is. Yeah. Then, Wallen, his name was. He was with me, and I got him to... He's about a 40-year-old Falkland Islander, and he... I said, look, just test my chin ribs for me. And he pushed them together like that. And I, you know, he did it with a great big hefty bunch, which I didn't mean him to do. And I was afraid he'd perforated the lung. Because the edge of a rib is quite sharp. Anyway, when we'd got going, I told Victor Russell in the evening, and I said, look, I don't really think I'm going to be much help to you with this rib. I've got the biggest sledge, and I can't, you know, getting it moving and looking after the dogs isn't really on.
You were out surveying at the time, weren't you?
Well, we were exploring, because what we were doing was to try and find if there was an overland route down, if the sea ice went out, because it was thin in places there. And he discovered this one day by walking along with his ice spear, and we had the 3 sledges behind us, and he was prodding it through to see how thick the ice was. And he suddenly stopped when he realised it was only 3 inches thick. 1,200-pound sledge. He said, back off, chaps. So we did.
Did you return to base with your broken ribs?
Yes, I had to. I said, look, I know you want to find out if there's a way across. I said, I'll stay with you to do that. Because up on the top of the glacier, it was fairly level, you see. It wasn't too bad. So we did that. And I said, I think I shall be more of a hindrance to you than a help. So I went back, and Victor and Rhys came out in my place, and I did the meteorological observations for till he came back.
And there was nothing much you could do for yourself?
Well, you can't do anything. No. All you've got to do with broken ribs is to bind it up and wait for 3 weeks.
Yeah. And you banged your head as well?
Yes, that was stupid. We had a blizzard that had been blowing for about a fortnight, and the snow built up all around the house, and we'd put Maggie and Pops up on top of the hut on the roof. And of course the wind generator propeller, we worked off that. And I was passing by and I saw that the pups were a bit close to this thing, and I thought, no, I'd better go and shift over from there. So I did. And there must have been a slight alteration in the wind, because it normally went round and round in the constant wind, which was very constant, you know, stayed at the same sort of force. And it must have just swung round, caught me on the head. I still got the
X-ray.
Hat in the...
Oh, the hat?
In the with the blood on it, in my wine cellar. And, of course, it knocked me out. And I woke up pouring blood from these cuts, because your scalp bleeds very easily. And I was woken by the dogs licking the blood. So I thought, oh dear, I've hurt myself. So I stumbled down back into the hut, down the snow steps, and the chaps were absolutely appalled to see me walking in, pouring blood from my head. So I said, well, look, we'll have to do something about this. And so they said, yes, all right, what should we do? Well, I said, I better have a look at it first. So we fitted up. I said, take me into the kitchen and put me on the floor, which they did. And I looked at it through a couple of mirrors. And I could see there was quite a gash across the top. And it was pumping blood from it. So I said, well, look, you'll have to put some stitches in that. And I said to Tom, look, you can do it. You saw me. I had to serve a dog bite on his hand out sledging. And incidentally, when we had those dogs, 60 of them dipped, not one of us got bitten. They took it incredibly well. Well, anyway, they put me on the floor and started saying, he started putting some local in, which I told him how to make up. But local goes in with a long, thin needle, and I could see that getting broken off inside the skull. And I thought, oh, that's not a good idea. I said, look, just sew it up as it is and don't bother about the local. So he, and of course, being a naval chap, he knew how to tie proper reef knots. And I told him how to tie a surgeon's knot, which, you know, is over and over twice, and then a reef on top. And he sewed it up. He healed up very well, stopped the bleeding. The only trouble was that I kept passing out in the process, and he had to wait till I came to before he could decide what to do next.
And you recovered perfectly well?
Oh, yes. Well, I'm only half the man I was, of course, after a crack on the head like that.
This is part two of the interview with Dr. James Andrew, recorded at Reigate in Surrey on the 8th of July, 2003. Dr. James Andrew, part two.
There's also talk in Ice and Men of this rather unusual camp called Swamp Camp.
Oh, yes, that was terrible.
In what way?
Well, that was coming back down off the winter journey, where we'd found a way across onto the top of the Russell Glacier from the northern end down onto the glacier. We'd come up later on the west, on the east coast, along the glacier, and then found the way on down south. But we came back off this, and we'd had such terrible weather that we couldn't... we couldn't do very much in the way of survey. We found a way anyway. And when coming back down, I got, we got down onto the sea ice in near Long Island, and well, still the blizzard had been blowing for a couple of weeks then, and all the sea ice had been pushed down with the snow blowing onto it, and of course the tide came in, and we didn't know we'd parked fairly close to a tide crack. I got stuck on a sastrugi, and they'd gone on ahead, and I lost sight of them, and by the time I got myself free, I couldn't, this is before I had the ribs damaged, I couldn't see where they were. And you know, with snow blowing everywhere, you've got to be a bit careful, otherwise you get lost. So I left the dogs where they were, having got the sledge free, and went out on compass bearings to for so many yards, and then back on the opposite reading, and kept doing this in different directions to see if I could find anybody. And on one of them, Vic Russell, who was coming back, must have seen me, because he came through to me, and I said, well, I told him what had happened, and he said, oh, yeah, of course I hadn't got a compass bearing or anything to go on. You know, chap Tail End Charlie didn't get that. He just had to follow the rest. Anyway, that's what happened. And we decided we'd camp, and Tom and I were sharing the tent, and we had a pretty rough night, difficulty putting the tent up. And we ended up, in the morning, he rolled over and he said, my feet are wet. I said, you silly fool, you've probably kicked the keypan, the pecan over. I turned over and my feet were wet. And we sat up in some concern and looked, and there was water rising up through the tent. So we hurriedly got out through the main thing, the main exit, you know, and told that, and by then the, you know, the tents were halfway up with snow. And we told the other chaps that we'd been swamped out. Could we come into them? And of course, by that time, one of our dogs had died. By that time, Victor, he'd been suffocated. Victor Russell decided that he'd better move his tent onto higher ground. So he dug it out with great trouble. Force 10 blizzard blowing all the while. And, you know, you could really hardly see what you were doing. And we eventually got it up in rather a restricted capacity. And just as we got it fixed, he snapped the pole he was pulling. And it was the only time I ever heard him swear. Anyway, we repaired it. And in a rather restricted tent, he said, look, he said, you better get inside that and cut that dog up, because they'd had nothing to eat for 3 days. And we'd been on half rations for a week. he said, you better get inside and cut that up before it freezes and give it to them. So I got inside the tent, and cutting up a dog inside a restricted capacity of a tent without making a mess of the whole thing is quite difficult. However, I managed it.
Using a pen knife? Or?
No, I had a
scalpel?
Dagger. Can't remember what. Well, my brother had given it to me. He was in the Royal Armoured Corps during the war, and he gave me this dagger, and I took it down there with me. Lost it fishing. On the Haven, and he was. I cut this thing open and divided it into 23 portions. We had 23 dogs left. And as I was cutting it, I came to the liver, which was a good-sized liver, and I looked at that liver and I thought to myself, my, I could do with a slice of that. After a week on half rations, and they were only 4,500 calories, you know, that wasn't really enough. We should have been on 5 or 6.
Did you give in to temptation?
No. Something said to me, don't eat dog's liver. Because there's a disease you get that produces cysts in the brain. Forgotten what it's called now. And so I decided against doing that. In any case, the dogs had to be fed. Otherwise, we wouldn't have got home.
The dogs had no problem in being cannibals?
Oh, none at all.
Right. And how was the episode concluded?
How do you mean?
Well, did you all get back into the one tent?
Well, we spent a pretty miserable night in those cramped accommodations. And we'd left our sleeping bags there. And the sledges there. Gone. We'd got the dogs running a bit loose. They curled up in the snow, of course, and were comfy. And we had one sledge left, so we were able to harness them up. When the storm eventually died, the following day, I think it was, and we got going and made for home. We were going, actually, to meet Bill Croft and Dick Wallen, who were looking for fossils in an island.
I'm conscious you're uncomfortable.
No, I'm all right.
You're all right, okay. Can we talk a bit about Deception Island? How come you were selected to leave there?
Well, Tom's father had died. Tom O'Sullivan's father had died, and he wanted to get home quickly. So he was out of the running. Bill Croft had come down for a year, and he got to get back. Dick Wallen wanted to get back to his family, a Falkland Islander. And what was the question you asked me?
Well, how come you became leader at Deception? It sounds like Hobson's choice.
Yeah, well, it was really. John Francis was staying on, and Vic Russell and I were the only two left, and he wanted to go and check on some other. We went to go to Paulet Island, where Nordenskjold expedition spent a year. You know, in fact, I've got his ice axe upstairs in my loft somewhere, which I broke killing a seal. I thought it was strong enough. And I've lost the trend again.
I was asking you why it was that you ended up being in charge of Deception Island.
Oh, yes, that's right. Well, they'd only left Vic and me, you see. He said, well, would you go, James? So I said, yes, of course. Quite happy to do that. But I said, I want to get back by the end of the year. Anyway, I did it. Agreed to go and do it for 3 months, and I was duly sworn in as a magistrate by Ted Bingham and Co.
Why was that?
Well, because we were all magistrates down there. At each base, we had one, because we had the Argentines quarrelling with us, the same trouble as they've got recently, the Falklands War, you know. And the Chileans were interested too.
So you have, by being a magistrate, you represented the government?
That's right, yes. And I had to deliver letters of protest to them.
Tell me about this. I've heard about this. What was the procedure? What were these protest notes? How did it work?
Well, we were in there in Bay in Deception Island.
Whalers Bay,
in the hut that had been made use of, which was, we were trying to repair enough to keep the snow out, which wasn't very clever. And we they came in and with a ship, and you know, I was advised that I ought to, because we got a special two-way system of communication, you know,
with
Bingham,
yeah, and Stanley.
Port Stanley. And we got a radio operator with us, Eric Massey, his name was, I think. And he was, I was told to deliver a note of protest, so I did.
You were protesting about what?
About their presence there. They said...
their base or their boat?
Their base.
Right.
No, they wanted to... No, their boat, rather. Because they sent their chaps ashore. And, of course, on the shore we'd got the old Norwegian whaling things, and there were a lot of explosives in there. Of course, these chaps found it and started letting some of it off. So I had more than one reason to go and protest to them. And went ashore, rode in there with my anorak and the other chaps, clambered up the steps, was received at the top and saluted smartly by Jimmy the One and the captain, whose name I've temporarily forgotten.
You're saluted by the Argentinians?
Yes, yeah.
This was on the shoreline?
No, this was on their boat.
On their ship, yeah.
And I said, please, can I see the captain? Yes, sir. Well, I said, does anybody speak English? And of course they all spoke English. No problem. And because I hadn't any Spanish at that time. And he said, he took me to see the captain. And the captain, I said, I'm required by His Majesty to deliver this letter of protest to you. And handed it to him. And he read it. And he said, yes. Thank you. Now he said, shall we go indoors for a drink? I couldn't resist that.
That was the first one you ever delivered, was it?
Yeah.
Do you remember what it said in this letter?
I didn't know how to write these letters, and I wrote a very stupid one, really. But I voiced our concern at his arrival and a protest at his being there.
So the composition of the letter was left to you?
Yes.
Did you ever get one back?
Not that I recall. No, they sent us ashore with a load of fresh Argentine meat, which was very good, much appreciated.
So they weren't taken very seriously by the men on the ground?
Well, I don't think, you know, there was a certain bonhomie involved in it all, really. And then the Chileans, of course, you know, sent a destroyer in, with the decks cleared for action, and files of soldier on board, and they marched in and wanted to know why we were flying the Union Jack at their base. And we said, well, we thought it was the best place to fly it from.
So tell me a bit more about that. When was that? That was in the 46?
47.
And they just arrived from nowhere, this
trip? Yeah.
Whilst you were there for the summer?
Mm.
What was the conversation between the two of you?
I laid over a letter of protest at their arrival.
So you went on board their
ship?
They
protested to me. And that's where it stood, you know. We didn't argue anymore. I mean, all we got was a 2-2, a faulty 2-2 and a shotgun. And they had a destroyer. I wasn't going to argue too much with them, but I had a protest to deliver, so we delivered it.
So again, you went over in a rowing boat to the
That's right, yeah.
ship?
And they... No, they came ashore, the Chileans.
Did they salute you?
No, I don't think they did. I don't honestly remember. It's a long time ago.
But again, once the notes had been delivered, what was the next thing that happened?
Well, they played around for a bit. Sailed up to the top of the inlet and then back out again to Neptune's Bellows. and we saw them now.
Did you offer them hospitality?
No.
No, that was a bit more stiff, was it?
Yeah, we weren't terribly keen on them. And after all, the British had pretty good relations with the Argentines. But of course, you mustn't forget one thing. The reason they didn't do anything about it was twofold. One, they knew that I'd got a radio operator and a form of communication with not only Port Stanley and the other bases, but the British Navy. And the British Navy was only a few hours sailing away. So there was no argument about what went on. You know, if we said, look, clear out, they weren't prepared to argue the matter.
Whilst you were there, did the Argentinians establish their own base on Deception Island?
No, they didn't.
That was later, was it?
That was quite a bit later. Yes, because we had the first of the earthquakes that shook Deception Island while I was there. And I rang them up at Hope Bay, or rather, cabled them at Hope Bay, and Stuart Small said, oh, James has had an earthquake. Typical, he said. Anyway, that's what happened. And five or six years later, it blew up. And it's destroyed the whole of the whaling base.
What was your earthquake like?
Well, it only lasted about 10 minutes or so. But, it worried me to death.
Did it do much damage?
Well, no, not really. But you see, there were fumaroles coming up with steaming hot water, steam coming out of the ground down by the shoreline. And Whalers Bay was reasonably warm because of them. In fact, one day we saw whether it was a Norwegian or an Argentinian vessel with a chap who was stark naked, dive off of the bow, looking as white as a sheet, swimming round to the stern, climbing up a net at the back, coming out like red like a lobster.
How much contact did you have with Stanley? Were you in daily contact with them, or just occasionally?
Well, we were required to be in touch with them at Hope Bay at certain times of the day to report the meteorological status. And, to make sure that we were all doing what we should do.
And were there ever instructions from them to you?
No, they all came from Bingham.
And he was?
In fact, I was told off by him when I got hit on the head because I hadn't cabled my family to tell them. And apparently they heard somehow that I was, the Foreign Office must have told them. So I hurriedly sent a cable to them saying I was all right.
How would you send a cable like that back to England? Would that go to...
Well, it would go via Stanley.
Did you have any direct contact with London?
Not that I'm aware of. Yeah. Except for the Albert Hall promenade concert.
But would you get instructions from London from time to time? Or where was Bingham all this time? He was
down on Stonington Island.
Right. So that the HQ, Centre of Operations, was Stonington. And you had direct contact with Stonington?
Yes.
Not via Stanley?
Well, I can't remember now.
Right.
The chap to ask would be Stuart Small, because he was the radio operator. I mean, I never learned Morse, and I never learned how to manage a wireless, so I didn't bother my head with it. I got enough problems to deal with anyway,
It sounds like the only man you treated was yourself.
Oh, no, Tim steward, no, not steward,
this is the dog bite.
Thomas Sullivan had a dog bite, which I had to sew up while we were out sledging on the way at the start of our first winter journey. And he cracked a fibula a bit later on. And who else did I have to treat?
Bonner, we've talked about.
Bonner, yeah. I don't think there were ever any major problems.
Were there ever any emergencies, really? You never felt as though your life was at risk at all?
Well, only when I slipped off the top of a mountain, knocking a bit of rock off straight towards a crevasse that I just crossed over on the snow bridge. I knew the snow bridge was good, and by the grace of God, I went straight across it on the snow bridge.
Out of control.
Out of control. I just gulped, and I didn't even have time to say, God help me.
Andrew Taylor says in one of his writings that he says, looking back on it, we did some very foolish things in the Antarctic.
Oh, we did. There's no doubt.
Can you give an example of?
Well, that was one.
Falling off the mountain.
Yeah, well, no, I went across to knock a bit of rock off. And I thought it was quite good snow. In fact, I can show you a picture of it on there.
We'll look
at it later.
Yeah.
And it was... and I had only taken a... a rock hammer, what do you call them?
Geological
hammer. With me, I hadn't taken an ice axe, which was very stupid, because I had no means... I took a spear with me, but the spear was only useful to see how deep the snow was. It wouldn't have stopped me sliding down the mountain, whereas an ice axe would. See, I'd have dug it into the rock and the ice. It would have held up, but the geological hammer didn't.
So it was a bit touch and go for a moment, was it?
It was a bit touch and go.
Did he play practical jokes at all?
Oh, yeah. No, you know, we were having a bit of an argument one morning at breakfast about who could run the fastest, and Thomas Sullivan said, well, I can, he said. So we set up. I said, I'll take you on any time. He said, lucky we both put on quite a bit of weight down there. And he said, all right. And Stuart Small and John Francis immediately latched onto this. And they said, right. They said, we'll measure out the distance from here to George Rocks and back, and you can run down there and back, and we'll give you the word of command, and I'll fire the gun. So after breakfast, quite a good breakfast, we usually had bacon and tomato and bread, toast and marmalade and a lot, porridge perhaps, and so we were feeling quite full. And I said to Tom, well, look, I'm going to give you a start. I said, you can have a 5-yard start. And Tom was most incensed. He said, no, I insist on starting with you. He didn't know then, of course, but I'll tell you this later. So Sam Small lined us up at the top of the slope, down to towards the George Rocks, and back. And John Francis, watched by all the rest of the crew, fired the gun when he was ready to go. And off we went. And of course, I'd been a half blue at Cambridge, and Tom had no idea. And I left him standing.
What was your reward?
Oh, just satisfaction. We both felt highly sick after that. So we sat down to recover and had a good giggle about it. But Stuart Small still remembers this.
Were there other recreational activities? Were you playing football? Or?
No, we didn't. We were far too busy.
No time.
You see, we had a lot of work to do. And
what about the domestic routine? I'm thinking now of Hope Bay.
Well, we did a week at a time cooking, each of us. And there were moans when Bill Croft had to do it. Poor old Bill, he was no cook. Alan Reese wasn't much better either.
Well, I'm thinking of cleaning and sewing and...
Well, we all did our own. The one thing you did have to be careful of was not setting a light to the roof. We'd got those tilly lamps, and stupidly they'd got hangers on them. And of course, because it was very dark in the hut, especially in the winter, people tended to try and hang them on the top of the on the bolts that held the roof together. We shouldn't have done that. That was very, very stupid. And of course, at one stage, I set a light to one, and I did not get told off. I tell you.
What you set fire to?
I put a tilly lamp on a roof rafter, and Victor Russell came along and looked at it, and he said, "We're on fire." And the rafter was smouldering. So Stuart came and put it out quickly with his fire extinguisher. But I learned a useful lesson then.
Again, that was Hope Bay.
Hope Bay, yeah. Yeah. And it was burnt down.
Oh,
and I expect that was how it happened.
Mm. So two men died, I think, did they?
Yeah. They're buried out there. Well, I'll tell you something else that was funny, too. When we'd been out sledging, we used to come back and have a bath when we could, about once every 3 months. And the first procedure was to go and get the snow in, and you'd tell everybody you were going to have a bath at breakfast. And you organised the snow and pulled it back, but it set the fire going, having cleaned out the mess the previous occupant had made first. And we had a big tin tub, you know, we had to bath in, and we used to put our clothes in first, after we'd had the bath, put our clothes in and stamp about on them, give them a bit of a wash, and hang them up to dry, which they did quite quickly, actually, even when it was freezing, because, of course, it evaporates. I've forgotten what the word is.
The wind, you mean?
No, when ice is, because they freeze the moment you put them up, but ice gets not vaporized. What's the word? I can't remember.
No, I'm sorry, I can't either.
Well, anyway.
Yeah.
Alan Reese decided he'd do this one day, and in order to rinse them, rather than going and getting a lot more fresh water, he said, we'd got a bit of a runnel coming past the house on this day, and he said, oh, I'll go and peg my clothes out in that. So he did, and come the evening, they were frozen in. And to the best of my knowledge, they're still there. Well, they won't be now because the temperature's gone up, yeah.
There's one more thing. You mentioned right at the very beginning that you, before you went for your interview, that as a boy you'd had this desire to go...
Yeah, well, I heard one of Scott's expeditions who came and lectured to us, and it fascinated me.
Was that Evans? Who lectured? You don't remember?
Can't remember. you're going back 70 years.
Yeah. So you're a boy, and he came to talk at school? Or?
Yeah.
Which school was it?
St. Lawrence College, Ramsgate. Right.
And that sparked your interest?
Yeah.
You're looking back, was this... looking back, James, do you regard it as being a key episode in your life?
Oh, good heavens, I wouldn't have... It was, aside from getting mad, it was the best thing I ever did.
Do you see anybody these days?
Only the ones that... I get to the Antarctic Club dinner in London. I can't go much further afield because I can't use public transport. And unless somebody's actually going up to wherever they are, but I don't go. There's a gathering of BAS at Cambridge in the near future, I believe, which I wondered if I'd try and go to, but I don't know.